Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk to Professor Mohammed Fadl. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. How are you, Paul? Good to see you again.
Good to see you. We met a couple of times, I think once in California, for sure, and once here in London couple of months ago. Yes. That was great. And today, you're in Toronto, of course, in Canada, and I'm here in London, England. So it's great to see you. Thank you. For those who don't know, Dr. Fadl is a professor of law at the University of Toronto, and he has published numerous articles in Islamic legal theory and Islam and liberalism. Now, in an article published just recently on April the 24th, titled "The Palestine Exception to Academic Freedom Must Go," you wrote the following. I'm just going to quote from the first paragraph, which I think quite helpfully, sets the scene for the article in general. You write, "American colleges are in crisis. For the first time in decades, Columbia University, it's one of the Ivy League universities in America, have engaged in mass arrests of its own students. Rather than deterring students, its actions have predictably resulted in more protests, not only at Columbia, but also at other colleges. It is easy to believe that this wave of campus protests is the immediate effect of the violence that began on October the 7th. But that would be mistaken. Palestine and advocacy for Palestine has long served as the boundary case for acceptable political advocacy in the United States. Advocates of Palestinian freedom, regularly denounced by their opponents as anti-Semitic, have long been the targets of campaigns of delegitimization and even demonization," end quote. Now, these are strong words. And these student protests have now spread, I think, to other Western countries. And we've seen here in the past few days, even to the universities of Oxford and Cambridge here in England and a number of others. So this is an ongoing campaign. So could you kindly just update us as to what is happening in the US campuses now?
Yeah, sadly, two things have happened. I mean, positively, campus protests, as I sort of suggested in that op-ed, would only increase in intensity as a result of repression. So that happened. So after the president of Columbia rather recklessly asked the police to clear an encampment, not only did that lead to increased numbers of students participating in protests at Columbia, solidarity protests picked up all over the United States. I think last count, there were over 100 different encampments were set up on different colleges in the United States. So that's really wide-ranging acts of, as I characterized it in my op-ed, civil disobedience, right? It's designed intentionally to provoke administrators into taking additional actions, aggressive actions, challenging them, so to speak. And just last night, for example, the University of Chicago, again, one of my alma maters, sent in police in the middle of the night to clear out a completely peaceful camp. Sadly, the same thing happened at my undergraduate and law school alma mater, University of Virginia, where on Saturday, I think it was May 4th, which was the anniversary of the Kent State Massacre in 1968, I think, of anti-Vietnam War protesters, the university sent in militarized police to clear out an encampment, maybe with, I don't know, 10, 15 tents, completely disproportionate response, and, you know, shocking in the level of police violence being used, particularly at a place, and here I'm speaking about the University of Virginia in particular, in 2017 that became notorious for the Unite the Right march that took place during President Trump's term, in which hundreds of white nationalist neo-Nazis gathered at the University of Virginia. None of them, as far as I know, were University of Virginia students. They marched and chanted very aggressively at night, threatened students, chanted explicitly anti-Semitic slogans. The next day, actually, some people died, but the police were never called in until, you know, blood was shed. In this case, you had perfectly peaceful students and faculty gathering on university property, speaking on behalf of Palestine, and the state of Virginia sent in militarized police. So the disparate outcomes are shocking for any objective and reasonable observer. And so that's sort of what I mean by the Palestine exception and Palestine being the border case of acceptable political discourse in the United States. There is the tendency to want to criminalize even the most inoffensive public expressions of solidarity with Palestine.
Complete your staining project with Pittsburgh Paints and Stains now at Menards. Stain in one coat with Ultra Advanced Semi-Transparent Stain. It's a stain and sealant in one that can be applied to damp wood and on hot, sunny days, allowing you to clean and stain your deck in one day. Save big money on Pittsburgh Paints and Stains and head into Menards to get your staining project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Just ask at this stage, it's a bit of a, it might not be clear to some people watching this, it's not even very clear to me, why the administrations of these universities who I had thought, perhaps wrongly, perhaps rightly, I don't know, were bastions or citadels of liberal left of center ideologies, wokeism, whatever. I mean, like a year or two ago, you know, the wokeism, as some people call it, seemed to have overtaken the American Academy in many ways. But here they are repressing or putting down or clearing out in a very aggressive militarist way, as you described, peaceful Palestinian, pro-Palestinian protesters who are protesting, after all, against actual genocide as we speak. So this is not exactly a cause that, it is a cause very much that one could righteously support. So why are these university administrations, which I used to think were, as I say, liberal left of center, suddenly behaving like, well, some people might even call them fascist. I'm not saying I do, but some people might characterize them as fascist.
Well, I think, you know, I've been of the view, and I've said it to lots of people, I don't know if I've shared it, my opinion with you, that this whole anti-wokeness was a complete distraction. Because as somebody who is part of the university system, who's gone through the university system, who spent most of his life in the university system, knows directly how conservative university as institutions are. And so the whole tendency of people to accuse universities of being incubators of radicalism and socially destructive, pathological, you know, woke ideologies was all, in my opinion, from the beginning, a smokescreen by the right to advance their agenda of shutting down universities as sites for free inquiry, free expression, free investigation, and crucially, building new kinds of solidarities and new kinds of coalitions. Now, to answer your specific question, why is it that administrators are so weak-kneed when it comes to Palestine? Well, the basic answer is they are subject to, they are vulnerable to massive political pressures, right? So in the,
who? You mean from government or state legislature?
All of the above, depending on the nature of the institution.
Right.
So if you look at an institution like Columbia, it's extremely vulnerable to pressure from donors. So a university like Columbia, Harvard, Yale, Penn, et cetera, these are institutions that for good or for ill are addicted to large sum endowments from wealthy donors, right? Many of these donors are virulently anti-Palestinian.
Right. Okay, I'm not doubting what you say, but why are the donors in particularly virulently anti-Palestinian? Okay, this is kind of very kind of basic ABC kind of questions for people who are outside of this world in America, this American system. Why are donors particularly anti-Palestinian? What gives there?
You know, you would have to ask them, right? But many of them come from, let me just say, Zionist backgrounds.
Ah.
And so they are committed Zionists.
Right.
And sadly, many of them are in the world of finance. So even before October 7th, right, hedge fund, well, I call them the hedge fund bros, were targeting the president of the University of Pennsylvania, demanding that she be sacked because she permitted a literary festival about Palestine to take place on campus. Now, what they were demanding of her was illegal. She had no power to shut down a literary conference, but they don't care about that. They want to find, they want university administrators to come up with pretextual reasons to shut down discourse that they don't like, right? And the irony, of course, is a lot of these same people were the ones promoting this sort of free speech agenda inside universities, right? But when it comes to Palestine, they don't think of Palestine as a free speech agenda. They think of it as an anti-Jewish agenda.
Right.
Right. And so they're perfectly willing to use the power that they have as donors and the power that they can exert indirectly through politicians to punish universities for allowing space for Palestine advocacy.
So distinction there, I hadn't quite grasped, so I wasn't paying attention perhaps. You were talking about private universities. So these are privately funded universities, but there's a distinction between public universities. These are published, so the latter then are funded by the taxpayer, presumably,
are they? Well, right. It's a little more complicated. Like, for example, my university, my alma mater, University of Virginia, is technically a public university, but because the state of Virginia has reduced its support for the university, the support, public support for the University of Virginia is effectively de minimis and has been so for many, many, many years. Yeah. As a consequence, it too is dependent on donor funding, but I don't think that's what drove the decision. The University of Virginia is kind of in the worst of both worlds because it's technically a public institution, right? Which makes it subject to pressures from politicians.
Oh, right? I see.
But at the same time, it doesn't have enough robust public support that can actually stand up to politicians.
But this is where I'm confused. Okay, so you've explained that difference, although it's not so binary as one initially might think, given the paucity of funding in Virginia, as you mentioned. But I also thought that in the U.S. there is a constitution, the United States Constitution, which, unless I've been misinformed, has an amendment which kind of guarantees free speech for precisely such public bodies or institutions. So why is there an issue there with the University of Virginia?
Right.
Which surely free speech is protected by federal law.
Absolutely. Free speech applies. This is again, what I'm going to say, that the difficult situation a public university finds itself in is that the Constitution applies to it directly, unlike a private institution.
Yes.
Other laws apply to private institutions, which I would also say also make their conduct illegal here with respect to their repression of Palestinian advocacy. But in terms of public universities, the Constitution applies directly. Yeah. But there's a caveat. So a public university is not like a public square. So in the United States, the degree to which the First Amendment gives a person free speech rights sort of depends on where the person is situated geographically, right? So if you're in my house, you're on my private property, right? You don't, the First Amendment doesn't protect you. Okay. First of all, I'm not a state actor, right? Second of all, it's my private property. So, you know, if you come onto my house and start speaking, talking trash, I can ask you to leave, right? No problem. Yeah. A university, a public university, is what you would say an intermediate zone. It's a zone in which the university owns the property, right? And as a proprietor, it has a right to establish certain rules about how its property will be used. So we call those time, manner, place restrictions. So the university has the right to establish time, manner, place restrictions on speech, or else it couldn't do its job, right? So you couldn't have a lecture hall. I couldn't have a lecture if students can just walk in and start yelling and et cetera, right? Okay. So the First Amendment allows an institution like the University of Virginia to establish neutral time, manner, place restrictions, right? But the aim of those restrictions cannot be to restrict particular points of view.
Right.
Now, what I'm trying to say, or what I was sort of alluding to very briefly in my op-ed, is that universities, in the wake of political pressure being brought to them by donors and elected politicians, are manipulating rules to try to restrict the spaces available for Palestine advocacy. So yes, in theory, you can have neutral time, manner, place restrictions. But if you are adopting them with the aim of suppressing a particular point of view, then that is unconstitutional. Now, the problem, Paul, is the following. You can have all sorts of rights protected by the law, right? But the law doesn't come to vindicate you at the snap of a finger, right? So it might be years before challenges to these policies, to these arrests, et cetera, make their way through the courts, right? And so what the strategy of politicians, sadly, is okay, we can go ahead and break the law because what we want to do is stop this movement. So we're willing to suffer losses in litigation down the road because that's going to come later. So it may very well be the case that courts decide that these policies were violative of the First Amendment, that the police used excessive force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But by that time, it would be too late. It would be years down the line. The, history would have moved on.
Well, and that's what their hope is. That's what their hope is. But my view is that Palestine advocacy has become so deeply embedded in civil society in the United States that it will require a lot more repression to uproot it. And this is where I think the desperation of Zionists is showing itself. Because everywhere around the country, you see them resorting to violence, either directly. Sometimes you have Zionist mobs attacking students, like you saw in UCLA. You literally had a Zionist mob attack peaceful students in the middle of the night.
Yeah, or you can see this on YouTube even, or Twitter. It was filmed. Yeah.
Or indirectly by pressuring state, local, and federal officials to use excessive police force against them, right? And you also had Congress passing wildly unconstitutional laws in an attempt to suppress Palestine advocacy. And all of that shows you that Zionists have lost the argument. They are incapable of mounting public defenses of the state of Israel. And so therefore they're resorting to state brutality. Now, does that mean they're going to lose? Not necessarily, right? But it does show where we are in this in public debate on Palestine in the United States among the younger generation, right? And so this is it's a critical juncture. We can either ratchet up oppression, ratchet up police repression, or we can take a deep breath, act as adults, and say we are going to adhere to our principles, our constitutional principles, and we are going to change course, right? Mm-hmm. We are going to require Israel to engage in radical reconstitution so that it can be consistent with the flourishing of not equal flourishing of all people, not just Jews.
Right. Indeed. Mm-hmm. Oh, just step back a second, looking at the wider historical context. In your view, are we living through an historic moment that is comparable to what the US saw and indeed Europe saw, Paris and Berlin and London in the 1960s, when you had student protests sweeping the board and mainly against Vietnam? I'm thinking the Vietnam War and the US military involvement there. Is this comparable to that moment? Are we seeing an historic moment, or with this, do you think what we're seeing now, will this fizzle out, do you think, and not be quite so comparable?
Yeah, I mean, I think every moment is unique. But I don't think this is going to fizzle out because, in my view, Palestinian freedom is the easiest thing in the world to support. Mm. It is not something revolutionary. It is simply asking for the international community to uphold the same rights for Palestinians as it recognizes for everybody else, mm-hmm. right? That's why it has cross-racial appeal, cross-religious appeal, right? Mm. Cross-class appeal, right? And so Zionism is what's exceptional. Zionism is claiming a right for a particular religio-ethnic group to establish a state solely for themselves, right? And in so doing, to place others who are not part of that group in a relationship of permanent subordination. Mm. That is a claim that is completely contrary to all public secular values of the post-World War II order. Mm. That's why it cannot be maintained through reasoned debate. It can only be maintained through force. And this is why I think we are at a critical juncture, just like in Vietnam, just like the civil rights movement, because you can no longer sustain a certain status quo through consent. People understand that there is a basic contradiction between the constitutional order of Israel as it exists and the values of the post-World War II international community. And so we have a decision to make. Are we going to stick with the liberal universal ideals of the post-World War II order, or are we going to legitimate ethno-national, ethno-religious domination, right? There's really, the choice is clear now to people, I think. And for youngsters, for the young generation, there's no way you can put that genie back in the bottle. Right. They will never go back to a day in which Israel is viewed from the perspective of the movie Exodus, right? Mm. So for people like President Biden, they live in this mythical world of Zionism that is depicted in a movie like Exodus, right? For this generation of American students, Israel is the poster child for everything bad about the war on terror.
Okay, can I push back a little bit again what you're saying? You talk about this mythical worldview that Biden inhabits and so on. I think on that particular point, you may be right. But some, I think, might say that there's another mythical worldview here in operation, and that is this idea of a post-war liberal international rule-based order, universal values. And they might push back against this kind of paradigm and say, well, was that ever really a reality? Because America has been supporting Zionism from the very beginning, back in the 1940s. So that's immediately post-war. And has taken sides very obviously in this when it comes to ethnic cleansing and providing Israel with arms. It hasn't really exhibited any of this kind of even-handed respect for international law whatsoever. And also that some people accuse the West of basically Western white supremacism, really, in its attitude. If we compare, for example, our natural, I say our white natural support and sympathy for the Ukrainians in their plight as being occupied, obviously, by the Russians, and how we welcome them, and we put up Ukrainian flags and government buildings, certainly here in London, I think in the States as well. But when it comes to, and again, I'm being crude here, but for purpose, when it comes to brown people, Muslims, Palestinians, you know, there isn't this equal handedness at all. And some would say that there is a racial dimension, that there's a Western supremacist dimension to this. And so the idea of an international, universal, liberal based order in the post-World War II world is largely a myth. It's a story that some people tell the world, but the realities of geopolitics underneath that veneer are quite different. Do you think there's some truth in that?
Yes, but it's important to know how that truth is understood, right? Okay. There's a difference between failure of aspiration on the one hand, as opposed to endorsing colonial world order on the other.
Right.
So yes, everything you said is true. There's been a lot of hypocrisy in the post-World War order, right? Obviously, the response to Ukraine versus Palestine is, you know, it speaks for itself.
It speaks right? for itself, exactly.
There's no rational person can dispute that. Yeah. But what's at stake is the following. Do we endorse a colonial conception of international law from a normative perspective and say that only white civilized countries are entitled to the protections of international law? Or do we say that we need to overcome the hypocrisies of the international order and provide these benefits to everybody, right? And until Gaza, right, the claim of Western powers is, yes, we know that we are imperfect, but we are trying to get better, right? And in fact, I would say that over the years, if you looked at the international system throughout the 20th century, I think there is a good, and the 21st century, I think there is a good case to say that we have made progress in achieving the aspirations of a more just, a more harmonious, a more peaceful international community. But what's at stake in Gaza is, are we willing to blow up everything that we have achieved in order to make Zionism legitimate? Because Zionism cannot be legitimate with the norms of the post-World War II era.
Come on, question that, because if one looks back to John Locke, I think John Locke and J.S. Monroe, John Locke, the famous founder in some ways of political liberalism, and his second treatise of government and his letter on tolerance. I mentioned him, this famous English philosopher in the 17th century, because even though he was a great proponent of tolerance and liberalism, at the same time, in his own mind, he was quite comfortable also with being an active slaver, so someone who worked for the slave-owning companies in actually I think it was Virginia or somewhere.
North Carolina, probably, I think.
Yeah, somewhere in what became the United States. Obviously, the U.S. didn't exist then. And I say that John Stuart Mill, who wrote a marvelous book, an Englishman, yes. Victorian England, he wrote a marvelous book on liberty. You know, it's a great standard bearer of liberal values. Everyone acknowledges that. And yet he himself, I've read his comments, says, well, you know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing very loosely here, but I remember reading him saying that, well, actually, liberal values are for white people, really, because the savages, the barbarians, i.e. the non-white peoples, can't really live up to this exalted idea of liberal governance and rule of law. So in other words, what I'm trying to say, I'm not... that these ideas of liberalism and colonialism, liberalism and racism, liberalism and have coexisted quite arguably in the eponymous founders of liberalism right from the beginning. And you see the United States in the revolution, which freed, you know, the Constitution of the United States, liberty and all that. And yet there was slavery in the United States until the 19th century. And even up to 1967, I think, before you got equality between whites and blacks in terms of citizenship. So it's not the case that liberalism is in some way the opposite of these other terrible things, but that historically it's actually lived with them quite comfortably in practice. And I mentioned John Locke and as examples of that.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Before World War II, right, you could speak of colonial liberalism.
Yeah.
Exactly as John Mill articulated it, that yes, these are sort of the right way to order society, but that's contingent on you having achieved a certain level of civilizational progress. Mm-hmm. If you haven't attained that level of civilization and progress, then it is proper for you to be subject to despotic rule, right? Exactly. Because now I would say, right, that even for Mills could only justify the British Empire on the grounds that it was bringing colonized people along the path of modernity, right? So at some point in time, right, although this was a farce, at some point in time, the Indians would be sufficiently advanced where they too could enjoy the benefits of liberty. Mm. But Zionism doesn't even promise that for Palestinians.
True.
Zionism seeks to modernize the Jew. So in many ways, Zionism can be viewed as a rebellion against traditional Judaism. But its aim was to redeem the Jew by making him modern and enjoy the benefits of modernity. But it holds no such ambition for the Arab. It wants to expel the Arab or keep the Arab permanently under its foot, right? Yeah. So it's a much worse conception. Mm. I'm not defending colonial Zionism, but it's an even more obscene version of colonialism than colonial liberalism. Now, my point is that nobody today defends colonial liberalism. Everybody understands that colonial liberalism is bad and that we need to overcome it. And what I would say that, as a matter of fact, right, even though the progress has been very halting and there's been, it would be too easy to mention all the hypocrisy, nevertheless, progress was being made to overcome that legacy of colonial liberalism and try to make the universality of liberalism more of an empirical reality rather than less of one, right? But what Zionism forces us to do is to confront directly, are we really serious about the universality of these liberal premises? Or are we really just colonial liberals that we believe that these premises are only for the civilized? Now, you notice that among other things Israel has been doing since October 7th, it is making explicit appeal to civilizational discourse.
Yes.
We are the bastions of civilization against the barbarians.
Douglas Murray from England has been lauded by, Douglas Murray, the English writer, he's been lauded by the Israelis and very active on YouTube and getting huge applause from the usual suspects. So, no, I'm just, this is exactly his point, that we are the civilized people, the others are the barbarians. And that's why we need to support Zionism and reject.
And so this is why this conflict with Zionism really makes everything very clear. Mm. The choice is, are we going to continue toward the progress of universal liberation, or are we going to revert to colonialism? Mm-hmm. Because Israel's logic at the end of the day is 100% colonial. It asserts its plenary right to rule over Palestinians, to kill them, to dominate them, based on a theory of civilizational superiority. It's because of this claim of civilizational superiority that Palestinians have no rights of self-determination.
But everyone seems to accept this. The German foreign minister does, the British, Cameron, the Americans, obviously, the whole of the European Union. They see Israel as representing a liberal democracy.
I don't know what they see.
society in the Middle East, surrounded by a sea of darkness. The European Foreign Minister said something quite similar about the analogy of a garden, a nice little garden, and outside is the jungle. And the garden was Israel, and outside of it was a jungle, right, which was all the Arabs and the Muslims and all these bad.
The problem there, Paul, is that none of that is relevant to international law. And this is why I'm saying there's a crisis. Palestine represents an existential crisis to the post-World War order because Zionism undermines all the principles of the post-World War II order. You cannot affirm the legitimacy of Zionism as it is currently constituted and at the same time affirm the principles of the post-World War II order. And this is why students are in rebellion, because as I was saying, as a general matter, liberal states in the West have affirmed the normative principles of the post-World War II order as a moral matter. And these values have been internalized by ever greater numbers of their own citizens. Mm. And so when they look at what Israel is doing, they recognize what's obvious, that Israel is illegitimate when these principles are applied to it neutrally, and they are demanding that policies change, right? And so in order to continue defending Israel, you have to revert to anachronistic ideas about civilization. Mm. And of course, that leaves aside the whole issue. Why is it that the Palestinians don't have the same number of Nobel Prizes as Israelis? Well, because they aren't given access to education. The British mandate prohibited Palestinians from building universities. The British mandate intentionally deprived Palestinians of education because they wanted to keep them ignorant, because they thought if they were ignorant, they wouldn't resist Zionism. Mm-hmm. Same story in the South, in America, where I'm from, the American South. Why were blacks not given access to education? Because they wanted to have a cheap source of agricultural labor. So the best way to do that is not let them learn anything. And then when they're ignorant, you turn around and say, oh, you see, they're ignorant. They don't deserve freedom. Mm-hmm. So especially in the United States, because we're a multi-religious and multicultural and multiracial society, right? It's not just Palestinians who are victims of colonialism. Huge swaths of the American population come from ex-colonized territories of the world. Mm-hmm. And so they see this, they see the treatment of Palestinians as the treatment that their parents suffered or their grandparents suffered. So they are naturally sympathetic to Palestinians. Again, that's why I'm saying I do not think that this movement will fizzle, because although Palestine is a small place, the issues that it raises are really quite profound for the international system.
Yeah. Okay. Just if I may just read another quote from your article. The article, just to repeat, is titled "The Palestine Exception to Academic Freedom Must Go." And you wrote later in the article, "Zionism, seen in its best light," an important caveat, "is a reasonable demand for a remedy to historical injustices against Jews. Palestinian nationalism, seen in its best light, is a demand that Palestinians cannot be forced to pay the price of historical injustices against Jews by sacrificing their own rights to self-determination in their historical homeland." And then you go on to say, "Negotiating these claims requires legal minds to cultivate both the professional virtue of zealous advocacy and the duty of fairness to one's opponent." That sounds very reasonable. But again, the question arose in my mind reading this. Is this sober legal solution a realistic possibility, given, for example, the existence of extreme nationalist members of Israel's cabinet at the moment, for example? Is this just too utopian? I mean, I'm not wanting it to be utopian, but the accusation is it's not actually that realistic, given the extremists in control at the moment, say in Israel.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a perfectly fair question. I can only say why I think it's, again, to throw in a Rawlsian idea, a realistic utopia.
Right? Okay. Yes.
It does seem utopian now, particularly as Israel is attacking Rafah and is engaged in genocide and is undeterred from stopping.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I think it's realistic to imagine a different future. And I do this based on, first of all, my own direct experience. I've lived most of my life in the United States and Canada. I've had lots of very fruitful professional relationships with Jewish intellectuals, both as teachers and as collaborators. And many of them are not Zionist, right? Many of them, in fact, are in the front lines of resisting Zionism. As an intellectual, I know that historically, Zionism was, when it first arose as a political movement, only managed to attract a very small minority of Jewish followers. It's essentially a reactive movement. It's a reactive movement to extreme forms of anti-Semitism, excuse me, that were prevalent in Europe in the 19th century, particularly Eastern Europe. I mean, I don't think we recognize the extent to which Jews living in Eastern Europe in what was known as the Pale of Settlement were subjected to horrific, horrific persecution, right? Now, the problem was people like Lord Balfour and other kinds of British politicians, because they themselves were anti-Semitic, right? They viewed Palestine and Zionism as a convenient way of solving their own Jewish problem.
And that's why Lord Montague in the cabinet at that time where Balfour was there was the only Jewish member of that cabinet and the only one who objected to the Balfour Declaration in 1917, precisely because he saw it as an anti-Semitic document enabling England to get rid of its Jews, basically.
Well, not maybe not. It did. He was concerned that it would authorize getting rid of England's Jews. But I think more importantly, from Lord Balfour's perspective, he viewed the idea of creating a Jewish national home in Palestine as a way to deflect Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe to England and divert them to Palestine, because he did not want them to come to England. And you know, Theodor Herzl understood this.
This is the founder of Zionism, modern Zionism, of course.
Well, he's considered the founder of political Zionism. So if you read his work, The Jewish State, which, by the way, is a mistranslation, the more accurate translation would be The State of the Jews, and there's a reason why that's meaningful. But in his book, he says that, you know, anti-Semitism, far from being an enemy of Zionism, is actually its greatest friend. Because he says the anti-Semitic powers will be our most natural ally.
Yeah.
Because they will be very eager to get rid of their Jewish populations.
And then a Mr. Adolf Hitler came along and made that the case in Germany in the 1930s, where there was an alliance with Zionists, or some Zionists at that time.
And so, you know, we have to recognize that Zionism is a reactive political ideology. That's why I would say, you know, from perspective of political theory, it's a very thin political theory. It's purely driven by conceptions of necessity, right? Now, the problem is, you know, necessity knows no law. That's why Israel justifies every crime for itself, because they've internalized this doctrine that they are like a breath away from extermination. Every person is a potential, every Gentile is a potential Hitler, right? And so if that is your internal sort of view of the world, it's not surprising that you allow yourself to commit these horrific crimes, right? Now, why can I still maintain hope in the face of this? Because I recognize that most people would find these theories to be obnoxious, right? And that historically speaking, they were very controversial within the Jewish community. so that they can only be sustained because of external support. Throughout the history of Zionism, right, Zionism has only been able to achieve the success that it has because of external great power support. In fact, you could say that it's been an abject failure. How? Well, if in fact Jews really felt that the Jewish state was the only place where they could be live safely as Jews, they would have all immigrated to Israel. But they haven't, right? And because they haven't immigrated to Israel, they haven't displaced the Palestinian population. And as a result, Israel is constantly having to resort to force to maintain its constitutional order, which is based on ethnic domination, right? So the fact is, most Jews, I believe, even though they pay lip service to being Zionists, they're only Zionists in a kind of cultural sense. You know, they love Israel, they love their Jewish comrades, their brothers and sisters, and that's perfectly fine. I understand that. That's perfectly reasonable. But what's not reasonable is establishing a constitutional order based on ethnic domination. Mm-hmm. And that is what's becoming obvious to everybody, right? And I think that more and more Jews in the United States, in Canada, I think elsewhere in living in the liberal West, will come to the realization that political Zionism is not compatible with their own understandings of what a just constitutional democracy looks like, right? Mm-hmm. And as that changes, right, the external support that Israel gets is going to decline. So once you recognize that the success of political Zionism is 100% contingent on its support by external great powers, and you see how vulnerable that relationship is, there's reason to be hopeful that reasonable conceptions of Zionism, when I say that, I mean conceptions of Zionism that recognize the equality of Palestinians, right, can replace chauvinistic conceptions of Zionism.
Right.
And so that's what we have to work for. We have to work toward creating conditions in which a reasonable conception of Zionism can replace chauvinistic conceptions of Zionism.
Mm, yeah. Well, perhaps we can draw to a close now, but I think one of the reasons I'm perhaps less optimistic than yourself is because I see ideological commitments to a supremacist Zionism coming from literally millions of, say, American Christian Zionists who have a particular eschatology, apocalyptic understanding of the end times, where they're not only do they feel they must support this current entity called Israel and the Middle East, but also they're motivated, I think, although it's less often expressed, but I'm convinced it's there, by a profound hostility towards Islam and therefore Muslims as well. And this kind of lethal combination, which may in part re-elect Trump in November, God help us all, is a very potent force. And this may rule the day, at least for a while, but even if your more reasonable, more liberal outcome is to be desired.
Well, a couple of things. I didn't say I was optimistic. What I wanted to say was that my political aims are realistic in the sense that I can outline a path forward that seems empirically possible, achievable, right? In that sense, it's realistic. I didn't say I'm optimistic that I will succeed or that we will succeed in achieving it, but these are aims that are realistic. It's not utopian in the Marxist sense of a classless society, et cetera, right? Now, you're right about the problems of Christian Zionism, right? Christian Zionism in many ways is the big elephant in the room. And historically, in fact, Christian Zionism predated Jewish Zionism.
Yes, it's very true. Very true.
On the other hand, I am comforted by the fact that in U.S. political history, Christian evangelical, right-wing Christian evangelicals have inevitably been on the losing side of every major political battle in the United States.
Okay.
So they are a very strong, entrenched powerful minority, but they are a minority, and they are geographically concentrated.
What, in the South, you mean?
Places like, yes. And so while they do wield immense power in certain regions of the country, they tend to also generate a huge amount of opposition. And the more that Israel becomes associated with Christian evangelicals, the worse it is for Israel. I mean, one of Netanyahu's stupidest moves was to hitch Israel's wagon to the evangelical Christian right. Because that automatically makes Israel toxic to a wide swath of Americans who despise the Christian right. So yes, the Christian right is highly problematic. You are right. They are ideologically hostile to Muslims, right? But at the other, but at the same time, they aren't a necessarily the be-all and end-all of American politics. No. So I don't want any of the listeners to think that I'm optimistic or that things are going to get better anytime soon. But what I'm trying to lay out is why it would be, it's realistic to imagine a different future. And this is why it's very important here. I'm going to speak now as a Muslim, right? It's very important to exploit, to take advantage of what I think are the universal values of Islam and the capacity of Islam to engage in friendship with others, right? To imagine a future of friendship across religious boundaries. Because one of the things that I believe is that Zionism triumphed in Palestine, not because Jews were necessarily Zionists, but because they saw no practical alternative. And so you can't beat something with nothing, right? So it's not enough to be anti-Zionist. We need to promulgate a not a post-Zionist future in which Jews can see themselves. The biggest obstacle right now to bringing in large numbers of Jews in our movement is, in my opinion, our failure to articulate concretely a post-Zionist, what a post-Zionist future would look like.
That's something that's not having given me much thought. This is true.
And I understand why, because in the midst of missiles and bombs and bullets, all you're talking about is stop the genocide, let us live. But that's why, you know, perhaps the burden is on us who aren't in the direct line of fire, that we need to articulate what we think a future Palestine for all its people could look like. And when we do that, I think you'll find this kind of inertial support for Zionism that exists among many Jews. Yeah, I mean, inertial in the sense that they support it as a matter of inertia, right? Will collapse. But we need to do that. We need to build a better, we need to conceive of a better future, lay that out practically as part of, you know, the project of Palestinian freedom.
Fantastic. Well, that's a very upbeat, positive note. And I agree, we need to focus on the longer term as well as the short term struggles for human rights and against the genocide and so on. Okay, just a final point, if we may. You briefly alluded to your idea of promoting civic friendship in the relationships between the two groups, the Palestinians and the Israelis. I wonder if you could just share with us some Islamic resources, specifically Islamic resources, that you think address this concept of promoting civic friendship.
Yeah, I think the Quran alludes to that in many places, but there's one verse which I think is particularly apt, and that's in Surah Fussilat, which is the 41st surah of the Quran, verse 34, in which God says, good and evil are not alike, they are not equal. Repel with that which is better or fairer or more beautiful, right? I push back against evil with something better.
Esa, right.
And then the Quran says, and it will be as if the one who is your enemy becomes your dearest friend.
Gosh.
Right, so.
Very powerful words.
Yes, so the goal of the Quran is not to encourage destruction of the other, but to replace enmity with friendship, right? Mm-hmm. And you do that by trying to establish the relationship on a basis that respects each other as persons, as equals. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I believe we should be working toward. That's really the only solution. Historically, we know that settler colonies can only conclude in one of three ways. Either the colonists commit genocide against the natives, or the colonists disembark and return or leave or go somewhere else, mm-hmm. or the barriers between the colonizer and the colonized are brought down.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And it seems to me the only morally feasible solution in the territory that we call Palestine is that the barriers between the colonizer and the colonized come down. Mm-hmm. Because the Jews have no place to go, right? The Palestinians have no place to go. I don't believe Jews want to commit genocide, right? And so given these realities, the only solution is to live together as equals in a relationship of civic friendship. And this is because that's the only feasible equilibrium solution, even though it seems utopian, because rationally it's the only solution that's morally defensible that everyone can morally endorse, then we have to work toward it.
I think we can't discuss this forever, but I think the idea that no Israelis want to commit genocide, I think could be queried given the plethora of quotes we have from Netanyahu downwards, talking about the Amalekites, the Amalek,
right,
which is a direct biblical reference to the Bible. No one was forcing them to use that language, and so they chose to use this rhetoric, which is a dog whistle for mass killings.
Well, I don't even think it's a dog whistle. I think it's express. What I mean by that, what I mean by that is that, the Quran teaches us to think of. The Quran oftentimes addresses us not as we actually are, but as our best possible versions of ourselves.
Right.
And so this verse addresses humanity in the best possible version of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that Israelis, the best possible version of them, are not desirous of committing genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so therefore, we have to work on a way of creating a common future. It's not enough to show that Zionism is a colonial ideology, a society based on racial subordination, which it all is, absolutely is, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But we have to replace it with something that is better. And that's what I think the Quran directs us to.
I mean, it reminds me in a way of what you're saying of what Martin Luther King said all those years ago, well, I have a dream and so on, and which at that time might have seemed very idealistic and utopian, but it was a vision that powerfully motivated many people and became perhaps more of a reality over time. And so, yeah, in pointing to a better world, you're at least creating a pathway or a map to that better world and through these Quranic verses. And so, yeah, I can see why that might be an aspiration worth or a vision to pursue. So I think that's what we'll leave it there. There's a great deal to ponder, and I will link to your article in the description below. It's well worth reading if you want to explore these issues in more detail, particularly from a legal perspective, I think. So thank you very much indeed, Professor Mohammed Fadl, for your time and expertise. Really appreciate it. And thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Paul. Great talking to you.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.